This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When my grandmother started to have complications with her eyesight due to glaucoma, she realized she couldn't drive anymore. It was not devastating exactly, but really, really hard for her. She was bitter about it to the end of her life, even though she knew driving was no longer a safe possibility for her. Even when she was dying of cancer and couldn't walk around anymore, she still told me that one of the things she missed most was being able to get in the car and go for a drive. It's a combination of losses. The loss of autonomy and independence, the loss of control, sometimes a stark reminder of mortality. And it can also make a person's life more difficult. How will you get groceries, carry on a social life, or even get to doctor's appointments if you live in your home and don't have access to reliable transportation? Figuring out when it's the right time to hang up the keys is tricky, and it often involves conversations with adult children or other people who start to observe deteriorating driving ability. Today on the program, we're going to explore how those conversations go and what the laws say about diminished driving skills. We're going to look at other conversations that also happen like this for adult children and parents and get some skills for how they can go in both directions, both from the kids' perspective and from the parents. I'm joined today by Pat McManaman, Highway Safety Specialist with the Vermont DMV, and Dr. Michael Lamantia, Associate Professor of Medicine and Director of Geriatrics at the Larner College of Medicine at UVM. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
How do you know, I mean, sort of bottom line, when it's actually time to stop driving? I guess, Pat, there's sort of a legal perspective on that. Maybe you could share the legal perspective first, and then we can get into those more sort of social and cultural ones.
Unfortunately, when the legal part of it takes effect is usually when the police get involved. We train our police on how to identify diminished skills. We want them to get away from thinking about age and think about the skill level of the person. And is there something causing that decline in skills? And typically when they get involved, it's due to a crash. It's due to the person crossing over the center line, hitting curbs, being called in as an intoxicated person, going down the interstate the wrong way.
Which happened recently.
Right. Yeah. And then they look at it and they look beyond the stop. Initially, they might think that they might have a DUI. When they identify that it, in fact, is not, then they go on and think about, could this be diminished skills? They're going to ask some questions. They're going to take a look at the person. They're also going to look at the history, the person's driving history, to see if there's been a decline reported recently. Then they can request a re-exam through the Department of Motor Vehicles. I want everybody to understand that anybody can request a re-exam. It could be a child. It could be a physician. It could be a nurse. It could be a neighbor. What we expect is if the person requests a hearing during that re-exam.
You mean the driver?
Right. The driver has the opportunity to have a hearing prior to the re-exam being ordered. If they request a hearing, then the person who made the report must appear at the hearing. Like any legal situation, the person has the right to confront their accuser.
So you can't anonymously call in on your neighbor and expect their driver's license to be taken away.
Correct. Law enforcement has a two-prong. If they observe the problem and they feel that it is a situation where the person is a danger to themselves or others, they can request DMV do an immediate hearing or an immediate suspension and re-exam. If the department finds a necessity for that, they will then issue an automatic suspension to the person and set a re-exam date. The other way would be like a typical person or a physician, family member. It comes into our office through a sworn statement. Then our agent, our department looks at it and will order a re-exam down the road. Will not automatically suspend the license. That's when the hearing gets kicked in. The person can ask for a hearing prior to that taking effect.
And if you're having that re-exam to see if you're still able to drive, is that the same as the kind of exam that you have when you're 16? I presume maybe the written test isn't there, but are you having a driving test and an eye exam?
There are certain tests that we can order. One is the driving test, which is the typical standard driving test. The second is the eye test, if we believe that it's vision related. The third is a medical, a physical, if we believe it's physically related, if somebody's on certain medications or they have certain illnesses. And it could be a combination of all those. The other one is the written test also that can be given.
You can be given the written test. Huh. Why? I mean
– for knowledge.
Yeah.
And on the written test, we show pictures of stop signs and yield signs and that. So it gives us an idea if the person recognizes what the sign is.
Listeners, I'm curious from you. I've been hearing from many of you on Twitter this morning about how these conversations are going in your family. And I'd love to hear if you have questions or experiences to share about how you have this conversation. If you're an adult child, how you have it with a parent, you know, the parent who raised you, who was this sort of authority figure, and now you're in a position to have a conversation where you are in some ways trying to exert some authority perhaps, or, you know, if there's a conversation that's not going well where maybe you're saying, no, look, Mom, I really am going to take the keys away from you. How do you do that? And if you don't feel like you have the skills, what kinds of questions do you have about how to have that conversation? And maybe you are somebody who's in your later years and you're thinking, this is a conversation that my kids are having with me. And, you know, I'd like to facilitate a conversation where I'm in control in as much as I can be over my own life and autonomy. I'd love to hear your perspective as well. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Dr. Lamantia, what about from your perspective, this idea of when it's time to stop driving?
Well, I think the statement that I'd make at the beginning of this is that my perspective as a practicing physician, as a practicing geriatrician, a specialist who takes care of older adults, is one where we're always looking to preserve the function and independence of our older adults for as long as possible. And almost universally, that's what I hear when I speak with my patients. They want to live at home. They want to stay as independent as possible for as long as possible. So with that said, these conversations, I acknowledge, are tricky. There is no one set recipe that works in all situations. But I really look at it from two sides of this equation. I look at it from the perspective of the older adult who I think should be aware of their own body, their own changes that they're experiencing day to day, and the limitations that they may be placing voluntarily around their own driving habits. Those persons shouldn't be afraid to initiate conversations early before it gets to the point of crisis with their children around, you know, listen, I'm scared about this experience that I had last night when I was on the road, and I think that maybe it's not safe for me to drive anymore at night. Initiating those conversations early before you get to the point of crisis is really key. Involving your doctor in these conversations too is important. It doesn't need to wait for sort of the standard 12-month visit that we have. You could call up your doctor tomorrow and say, you know, listen, I had an experience the other night when I was driving that scared me, and can you work me in for an appointment with you in the next few weeks so that we can set some time aside, talk about these issues and come up with a plan.
Do you find that patients do that? I mean, do people have those conversations with you before they're at a crisis point?
Right. So there's a lot of stigma associated around this. And so it's the rare person who will come into my office and will bring up these issues voluntarily. If you spend enough time working with older adults, though, as I do, me and my colleagues, I mean, we find that these issues are below the surface. And if you dig a little bit, you can find the little threads that you can pull on and start the conversation around these issues. But it's a difficult topic. People frequently in this area of the country have been driving since the time that they were 15. And so if you're having a conversation with them at age 85 about this, you have to sort of confront that sort of 70 years worth of habit of having sort of this American freedom of going out to your driveway and getting into your car. You're threatening that on some level.
I hear what you're saying too about setting some boundaries, and I imagine that a tough conversation to have, whether it's with the DMV, which maybe you don't have to have it quite yet, or with your doctor or with your kids about maybe putting some limits on your driving but not stopping driving altogether, you know, that's a tough conversation to have too, I imagine, because you don't want your kids to suddenly think you shouldn't drive at all when what you may be saying is, I'm not comfortable driving at night anymore, or I'm not comfortable driving in the rain, which, you know, are two situations that are difficult for anybody driving. And if you're starting to feel like maybe it's not that comfortable for you, I can imagine broaching that conversation, but worrying that your kids are going to say, well, you shouldn't be driving at all. I'm taking the car. Does that happen?
Well, I think that it's important in any of these situations to personalize the advice that you're going to give to any individual, to their situation. That's at the heart of providing person-centered care and person-centered advice. So you want to be quick. You want to avoid being quick to jump to simple answers about, no, we're going to take away the keys completely. There sometimes are other solutions that fall way short of having to take that final step.
Yeah, go ahead, Pat.
We actually see that a lot when we're doing the re-exams. We see that a person comes in and they have regulated themselves, whether they can't see well when it's raining, so they stop driving during the rain. They don't like the high speeds of the interstate, so they don't drive the interstate. And they self-regulate. And then it's later on where we start to see the decline where they shouldn't be behind the wheel. But one other thing with the conversations is the family as well as the person has to identify what is important about driving, the most important thing about driving, and then work with that and coming up with a suitable answer to that. What I mean by that is, for instance, if the important thing is they like to be spontaneous and be able to go out on trips, the family works with them in saying, okay, you set dates and we'll make it work and we'll take you out.
Which doesn't allow the spontaneity perhaps, but still right. Allows you to have those trips.
Right. If it's a status thing that I want the car, you leave the car parked in the driveway so that it's there. You don't take the actual car away. So you have to – both sides have to – the parent as well as the child has to identify what is important in driving.
We got a note from Rosemary on that, though, who says, there is a great misconception out there. Many old folks do not want to drive but are forced to if they want to survive. There's no public transportation in many towns. Driving is just a matter of survival. Instead of adding to the false belief, why not try to find solutions? So, I mean, Pat, there are sort of reasons, like you mentioned, status reasons and social reasons and reasons related to a feeling of independence and autonomy. But there's also that question of, how the heck am I going to go get my groceries if I live in my own home and don't have reliable transportation? And there are options out there. But we got an email from an organization who says, yeah, we provide rides, but we always have more people who need a ride than we have drivers. So that must be something that you encounter as well at the DMV.
It is. And I think as a community, we need to take a real good look at that. You get into areas that have buses and have the taxis available. It's not such an issue. Where if you get to the outlying areas where the person is in their home and they're, you know, 20 miles up a dirt road, it becomes more of an issue. But we as a community have to work on that and make sure that a person who, no matter what their age is, that is not capable of driving any longer and has that independence to do what they need to do, that we make it happen for them.
Dr. Lamantia, I mean, I notice even for town meeting, which is coming up in my town, there have been some posts on our Facebook and Front Porch Forum pages saying we're offering rides if anybody needs a ride. You know, do you see even those kinds of issues coming up with patients?
Yes. I mean, transportation is a major issue for older adults, and it's one of the major concerns that older adults have in giving up those driving privileges. This idea that you're going to be shuttered in and closed off from the rest of the world when you potentially have had this freedom for the last 70 years. I think what is sometimes not obvious, though, to older adults when they engage in these types of conversations and ultimately potentially face this sort of decision to give up the keys is the number of people out there who are willing to help. Right, because they've been independent for as long as they've been, it may be a tough question to ask, but sort of raising your hand and saying, who in the community around me is willing to help me out and get from place to place? And I've seen some wonderful sort of embracing of older adults around these types of issues and people really going above and beyond, oftentimes without any recognition at all, in order to keep these older adults moving from place to place around in their communities.
These are conversations and thoughts that many people are having. We got a note from Annette who says, my father gave up driving after I told him the story of a friend whose father had refused to quit driving over the age of 90 and hit a teenage girl on her bicycle. Fortunately, the girl was not seriously harmed, but my father was sensitive enough to recognize his frailties and did not want to think about doing something similar. My mother then took over driving, and when she felt unsure of herself, she had me take her to the Department of Motor Vehicles to turn in her license and get a replacement ID. They said at the DMV that what she did was rare. Hope emailed in and actually helped us spur on this conversation. And she says, in Vermont, we have all sorts of regulations about when and how teenagers should be allowed to drive. On the other end of life, the regulations just don't seem to be in place. As the daughter of parents in their late 80s, I have to say that it was extremely frustrating to know that my parents should no longer be driving, but get no support at all from the state. I once asked the police chief in my town if there was anything I could do to make them give up driving, and he said that you need a doctor's declaration stating they're no longer fit to drive. He said it has to do with not discriminating against them because of their age. There's all kinds of advice about having the difficult conversation with your parents and how to convince them to stop driving, but it is a very tricky line to walk, trying to show respect to your parents, but also trying to keep them and others on the road safe. So, Pat, what you said is anybody can actually make a declaration that somebody may not be fit to drive, but then they have to be willing to sort of out themselves and be willing to show up at a hearing if the driver requests that.
Correct. It's not just a doctor that has to make the recommendation. It could be anybody. It could, like I said, it could be a family member. It could be anybody else. As far as having that conversation, there's two places or three places that actually give some good information on having the conversation as well as also help the mature driver. One is the American Association of Motor or American Automobile Association.
AAA.
The other one's AARP or the American Association of Retired Persons. NHTSA, which is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, also has some good information. And the Vermont Highway Safety Alliance, VHSA, also has some information about diminished skills.
And we'll put those links up on the show page today at vpr.net for people who are looking for that. Let's go to Anne, who's calling in from Wheelock. Hi, Anne. Go right ahead.
Hello. I just want to share an experience. I was taking care of my grandmother for many years later in her life, and I couldn't have this conversation. And she actually killed somebody a week later, then took her life. And I just want to say how important this conversation is. It just must be had. It just must be had. It would have been a much easier to have the conversation than to bury her.
Anne, I'm so sorry for your experience and for everybody who was involved in that. And thank you for being willing to share it with us, really putting a stark point on what can happen if you don't have these kinds of conversations. We're going to carry on our conversation about this as well as, you know, how you have difficult conversations in general with your parents as they age. And from the parents' perspective, what do you do if you think that maybe your kids are jumping the gun on this and that you actually are still safe to drive, but your children are worried? Lots to talk about. If you want to share your experience or ask a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211 or post your note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're exploring how to have some tough conversations between parents and adult children as parents get older, and how you yourself, as you get older, can start to evaluate your ability to still drive a car or do other things that have been part of your life for maybe your entire adult life. If you have a question or an experience you'd like to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking today with geriatrician Michael Lamantia and DMV Highway Safety Specialist Pat McManaman. And hearing from many of you, Elizabeth Ann says, I've already been through dealing with elderly parents, but my husband and his siblings have not. His parents need significant assistance and they live out of state, but my husband's siblings apparently have blinders on and don't act upon the obvious needs for intervening or advocating for their parents. For example, they shouldn't be driving, they frequently fall, their home isn't a safe environment for elders due to steep stairs, etc. What can we say to the siblings without offending them or the aging parents to get their needs addressed before there's a major accident? Dr. Lamantio, what's your advice?
I think that we have to consider that safety needs to be our number one priority here. So if we think that something dangerous is going on, we need to sort of stick to our guns and make sure that we're going to address it. It's not an uncommon situation to have relatives who live out of state who are deeply emotionally involved with what goes on with mom or dad, but still lack the perspective of day-to-day life with mom and dad to see the limitations that are occurring and the changes that are occurring. Mom and dad are frequently very aware of these things going on. And so you need to foster a conversation with those loved ones, whether that's you ask them to take time away from their busy lives, which I know is always difficult, to come to spend a week potentially and see what's going on with mom and dad, attend a doctor's appointment, learn the doctor's perspective on how mom or dad is doing. Sometimes it can help to have a conversation with professionals beforehand to sort of set up, you know, that this is something that we're concerned about and that we're seeing. I mean, you have to be a little bit careful with that, right? Because you want to make sure that you foster an environment where it's an inclusive conversation that doesn't turn confrontational, that doesn't turn into people digging in their heels. There's by no means a sort of simple cookbook answer to these types of things. Each situation is different, but there are some guidelines that you can follow.
Yeah, you want to give us a few more of those? You know, how you sort of broach this conversation without
shutting
people down?
Well, exactly. I mean, you want to approach this conversation from a spirit of inclusiveness. You don't want to turn this immediately into being a confrontation. By that, you can oftentimes set it up right by picking the right time. Choosing to have this conversation during the middle of Easter dinner or on Christmas Day is probably not the right time. Know that this isn't a one-shot deal, right, where you're going to come in, you're going to give 45 minutes of time, and at the end of those 45 minutes, everything's going to be done. This sometimes has to happen over a period of time, a series of conversations. Understand and make room for emotion and address the emotion that is understandably going to be connected with it. Investigate alternatives ahead of time for driving. Know what resources are available in your community. And in order to find out about those, connect with professionals. You'll find that there are lots of organizations out there in our communities who have developed resources, some of which Pat has referred to earlier, that you can access ahead of time to understand what alternatives you might be able to offer if that's where the conversation goes. And you want to make sure that you get your other family members on board with this. It always is sort of a difficult or more difficult conversation if you go down a road in your 30 minutes into the conversation and then somebody else sort of cuts you off at the knees in the conversation and says, well, I just don't believe anything that you're saying here, and I don't think that there's a – right, then that conversation is going to take a sort of nasty turn into the woods. These are the types of strategies that you could employ to hopefully make what is a difficult conversation go a little bit more smoothly.
And those would apply to other kinds of conversations about, you know, whether or not to stay in your home or, you know, what about financial considerations or what do you want for medical decisions down the road? I mean, those are all strategies for any of those difficult conversations.
Correct. I mean, the best time to have these conversations is, again, when you're not in crisis mode. And these types of strategies can apply to conversations about finances, to questions about living arrangements, to questions about goals of care at the end of life, to difficult conversations around clutter and upkeep of the home, as well as when is the right time to bring in help.
We got a note on the sort of flip side of that and going to that idea of what happens if family members don't agree from our own VPR colleague, Ty, who says, my sister decided on her own that it was time to take mom off the road. My feeling is that it was too soon, but it looks like there's no convincing my sister of that. What's your advice for how to talk to your siblings about talking to your parents? Or, you know, Pat, I'll throw this to you first. Or, you know, if you are the driver in question and you feel like maybe your adult children are – maybe not eager isn't the right word, that they're not doing this out of some eagerness, but out of concern. But you really feel like, no, I am still okay to drive. You know, how do you sort of backtrack that conversation?
First thing is again, find out what's important to the person as far as driving. What is the most important thing to them? Another thing that a child could do is ride with the adult driving, ride with the parent driving, and watch them, observe them, and jot down things. It could be that, you know, yeah, mom had an accident or a crash, but I go out with her and she's fine driving. That's a one-time thing. Or it could be that I go out with her my father several times, and he's hit the curb. He, you know, has gone over to the double yellow when he's making a right-hand turn. When he turns left, he turns into the oncoming lane. Those are more serious issues and would key in that there's something going on here. Once you have that documentation where you've jotted it down, I think the conversation with the siblings, these are the things I observed. And please, by all means, go out and observe the same thing. And then we can talk about it where we both or the three of us or whatever are able to sit down and have an educated, reasonable discussion about it. And we can also have that discussion with our parent. Don't confront the parent. The last thing you want to do is get into a confrontation with them. You want to approach it in a non-confrontational, trying to come up with a solution to the issue.
I think in that type of situation, using I in conversations rather than you is frequently a useful strategy. So saying, I'm concerned because when I drive with you, I see this, rather than saying, you're a bad driver. Right, there's a very different feel to that, and it acknowledges upfront that there is emotion involved with this. It's not just about state the facts, ma'am, and just the facts. That doesn't sway the day when you're back at home talking with a parent about this. And we like to address these issues before it advances to the point that we have law enforcement authorities involved with needing to take away driving licenses.
We got a note from Pamela who says one of the more challenging aspects to this topic is around memory loss and driving. The Alzheimer's Association Driving Resource Center offers helpful tips and tools for having the difficult conversation, planning ahead, and recognizing signs of unsafe driving. I'd love to hear more about the topic of cognitive impairment and ways of working with families. Key is being proactive and planning ahead versus reactive and waiting for an accident to happen before putting supports in place. And we'll come back to that. I want to get a couple more comments in here. Sheila says, my dad and his wife both turned 91 in June. They were both driving until a couple of weeks ago. They've both started to have minor accidents. My stepmom was also occasionally confused about things like how to turn on the headlights. Instead of having a confrontation, which would certainly have involved hurt feelings, my sister called my stepmom's doctor and gave her a heads up. The doctor then asked my stepmom to be reevaluated. My stepmom no longer drives. One down, one to go. And here's Bonnie calling in from White River Junction. Hi, Bonnie. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Well, I'm actually an occupational therapist and a certified driver rehab specialist. And I work a lot with elderly people who are noticing changes in their driving skills but want to continue to be independent through driving. And we offer evaluations to see where they're at and to see if they're appropriate for some retraining. I think one of the things that's really important to think about with a lot of these elderly people is vehicles have changed, technology has changed, the driving environment has changed. Many of the people we see never had driving lessons, never took driver education in their youth, and really are lacking some basic skills which can be reintroduced when they're older, provided they have the cognitive and visual skills to do that. So it's another resource rather than just sending them to the state for a test where they pass or fail, or a doctor trying to make a decision about whether somebody, you know, is capable of driving without really actually being able to evaluate their driving skill. So it's a service we provide. There are two programs that do what we do in the state of Vermont. One is up in Burlington at UVM, and the other one is here in White River.
Bonnie, thank you so much for suggesting that. You know, to be honest, it hadn't occurred to me to think about, oh, you could actually do some training to work on your skills and maybe extend extend your driving ability or your driving years by sort of re-upping those skills. What a great idea. Thank you for sharing that. And let's go to Beth calling in from Springfield. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi. I have an experience and a question to share. I recently was stopped at a stop sign and an elderly gentleman just crashed headlong right into me and totaled my car. And he begged me not to call the police and said he was surely going to lose his license. And when the officer arrived, he said that this gentleman had just recently gotten out of the hospital from having had a bad accident where he was injured at this same intersection. And I was just sort of curious about when and how the community steps in, and because this particular gentleman didn't have any living family. So what happens with people who are really truly on their own? Who steps in and at what point? How does that work?
Beth, I'm sorry to hear about your experience as well, but Pat, what about that idea of when to step in?
It would come when the community observes that there's an issue going on, because, again, they're going to have a factual basis to request a re-exam through DMV. The last thing I just wanted to mention was that if we put somebody under suspension, it doesn't mean permanently. If they are able to drive after a period of time, they can retest and get their license back.
We got a note from Stevie in Richmond who recommends, I don't have time for this, A Compassionate Guide to Caring for Your Parents and Yourself by Catherine Arnup. Stevie writes, having had experience with my parents and others, I wish I'd had access to this wonderful and thoughtful approach to the aging process. We have other resources on our webpage as well from listeners writing in, like Angela, who says, I work in the aging field and have learned there's a whole network of organizations and individuals dedicated to gently helping older Vermonters navigate the world of aging and link them to the many supports and services in our communities. And Melinda, who says she works with those who are blind or visually impaired as a certified vision rehabilitation therapist, and says the Vermont Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired has a volunteer driver program designed to be an option of last resort for those who can no longer drive due to vision loss. Dr. Lamantia, I'll leave the last word to you here. This is a difficult thing for people, and you know, as we've talked about, this is a real part of your sense of self if driving is important to you. It's a part of your autonomy. It's a part of your independence. And it's also a part of your survival. So these are difficult conversations to have and difficult for kids to think about them.
Yes, certainly. I mean, and so what we need to do is not be afraid to have these conversations. We've talked today about strategies that we can employ to make these conversations a little easier to engage in. And please do not be afraid to start the conversation.
And you could talk to your parents' doctor as well, right?
That's
for tips like you're giving us today.
Correct.
That's Michael Lamantia. He's an associate professor of medicine and director of geriatrics at the Larner College of Medicine at UVM. And we've also been talking with Pat McManaman, highway safety specialist with the Vermont DMV. Thanks very much to both of you. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, last week, President Trump rescinded the Obama administration's directive on school guidelines for transgender students. Has it changed anything for Vermont schools? We'll find out next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, President Trump rescinded the Obama order compelling public schools to let students use restrooms that conform to their gender identity, not their biological sex. That guideline had not been fully implemented nationwide because of a legal fight, but Trump's decision to roll back that executive order effectively leaves the decision up to individual states and potentially individual schools. Last year, the Vermont Agency of Education released what it calls best practices for Vermont schools regarding transgender and gender nonconforming students. To explain now what the federal changes mean for Vermont, we're joined by Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, newly renamed to that position by Governor Scott. Secretary Holcomb, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Did President Trump's changes change anything for Vermont?
They didn't. Vermont's best practices are really grounded in state law, and so any change at the federal level in the way it's currently configured doesn't have any impact on our continuing best practices here in the state of Vermont.
Yeah, as you say, these best practices are in line with state law, and the AOE best practices say that children should be able to be safe and secure in their school environments no matter their gender identity or their sexual identity. that's law in Vermont already under our anti-discrimination policies, isn't it? So is school policy just an extension?
Right, that's correct. So state law was actually, gender identity was put into our public accommodations legislation in 2007, signed actually by the Douglas administration, and it really prevents denying any person of any of the reasonable privileges, facilities, advantages on the basis of gender identity. And so that really is the context in which we do this legally. And I think just as a basic core principle of educational access and equity, we're committed to making sure that all students feel safe and supported, and that includes students who have a gender identity that is it really is self-determined, so we need to support them as they determine they are.
The Obama administration's position on bathroom policy specifically was that allowing students to use the bathroom of their choice based on their gender identity was in line with federal policy under Title IX. Is that the state's position as well?
Again, when we drafted our policy, we really focused on the fundamental right of students to not be discriminated against on the basis of gender identity, which is really provided by Vermont statute. So we didn't base our, we made a decision to not really focus on that. It's always been the state policy that we need to provide safe, orderly, and supportive learning environments that are positive, and that means that we need to make sure that all students have access to anything that's entitled to any student under state law. And I think all students have a fundamental right to privacy, regardless of who they are and how they identify themselves, and all students have a fundamental right to be feeling safe and valued as who they are, and supported as who they are in their school environment. So it really is an extension of a basic state policy. So we really didn't think about it in the context of Title IX here in Vermont.
How specifically does that policy of the state apply to restroom use? Because that's come up as a big issue, or certainly sort of a totem issue in these policies nationwide.
Well, one of the reasons we focused on best practices and we declined to specify at the state level exactly what it should look like is that we realize that every student is a little bit different. We realize that our school facilities are all different and the circumstances of individuals is very different. So we really wanted to outline principles, and the basic core principles are that every student has a gender identity, which is self-determined, and that every person, including any student in our school, has a privacy right, and all students have a right to feel safe, and all schools have a right to a school environment where they're free from discrimination. But that what that might look like in different schools is a little different depending on what kind of bathroom facilities they have or what their physical structure is, or frankly, what the needs of the individual child are. And some of our small schools, for example, every bathroom is a single-person bathroom, so just make every bathroom gender neutral and there's no issue at all. Others may have multiple stall bathrooms, so you need to think about making sure that every student has access to the bathroom that they feel is necessary. There are students who are sort of gender traditional who still want single stall bathrooms, and that's okay too. You know, so it's partly making sure that whatever your configuration is meets the needs of the individual child, and working with the individual child to figure out how to make that happen in their own context. It really just is about figuring out what individual children need to be able to be safe and supported, and acknowledging that looks differently, and giving some guidance or suggestions to our local systems so they can figure out how to make it work, but really entrusting them to have those local conversations to figure out the best way to make those principles work in their own unique individual context. I have to say it's been more of an issue from what we can tell with some of the adults. We are not hearing from children that this is a big problem.
Well, except that last year, I think that the last time that we spoke about these best practices on Vermont Edition was in the context of a school that was dealing with this issue and had been trying to work out a respectful way to deal with the bathroom issue. And the solution had been to allow a student to use a unisex bathroom. But that student said, well, now I'm being treated differently from other children who use a multi-stalled bathroom that I am not really supposed to use. And so for the school and for the school community, it was, again, this discussion of, well, how do you have policies that are respectful, but also, you know, allow the student to choose what's right for him or herself as an individual. So it is best practices, but they do come up in these actual very specific questions once schools are trying to deal with them.
Right, and I believe the incident you're speaking about was happened right prior to our issuing of best practices. And if I recall, one of the triggering events was that students in the school actually walked out in support of a transgender peer. Again, the students were comfortable with supporting and advocating for their peer.
Some of the students were, at least.
Some of them were initially, and I think the bottom line is what you have is a child who simply wants to be able to define who they are and have the world see them as they see themselves, and a school that was open and willing to working with them in order to figure out how to make that happen. You know, there was a precipitating event. We were able to provide some best practices and support to help them think through some of the issues, and that's what we need to have happen. And my understanding is that they did do that. They worked through it with their community, and things are now moving smoothly.
The guidelines sent out by the state last year, as we've been talking about, are called best practices. They're not called bylaws. They're not called something similar that connotes compulsion. So could schools in Vermont cite President Trump's position and push back on, for example, a bathroom policy?
The decision that is being dealt with at the federal level is based in a different set of laws. So again, it doesn't apply. No one could push back on that decision or use that as a rationale for a change, because the particular piece that's binding in our context is our own state law. So no, again, it's not relevant.
But just to be clear, a school in Vermont could say, we are not going to allow a child in our school to use a multi-stalled bathroom that does not conform to that child's biological sex because we have a different accommodation. I mean, they're allowed to provide different kinds of accommodation based on what they see as best for their schools?
No, because the law is actually quite clear. Again, it was the issue of gender identity was put into state law in 2007, signed by the Douglas administration. And it's very, very clear that public accommodations can't refuse, withhold from, or deny to any person any of the accommodations, advantages, facilities, and privileges of that place based on gender identity. So no, that would not be an argument they could make.
Just so I'm clear, though, I mean, I thought that it was allowed that schools that have multi-stalled bathrooms in Vermont don't necessarily have to make changes that allow transgender students to use them at this point if they have other types of bathrooms available.
It's really about what the student wants. It's not that the school has the ability to tell the student how they'll be served. It's really about what is going to make that student feel safe and privileged and welcome in that environment.
So if the student says, I want to use this bathroom, that student can use it.
Right. If the student is not comfortable using that bathroom, then they might choose or might be more comfortable in a gender-neutral bathroom or a single bathroom stall. So it really is about what the student, and there are students who, for a variety of reasons, do or do not feel comfortable in different settings. And what we really need to do is go back to the principle that all students need a safe and supportive school environment. What is it that's going to make this individual child feel safe and supported in that context?
And it's not just about bathroom policy, obviously. I mean, there are other issues and other situations as well, and the state guidelines are pretty clear about making sure students are comfortable and that they have a right to their own identity and the sense of self. What about something like sports teams? What's the law in Vermont about what team students are allowed to join?
The VPA, and I encourage you to follow up with an interview with the VPA, the Vermont Principals Association, which has done a fair amount of work in this place, and they could speak to you about both the logic of where they are in terms of practices and where to go from there. We haven't done that work.
So the State Agency of Education doesn't have a policy on students, because my understanding of the Principals Association is that Vermont students are allowed to join whichever team they choose based on their gender identity, but that's not a state policy.
They would be subject. It would go back to the same principle that I mentioned earlier, which is public accommodation, a place of public accommodation, which is a school, cannot discriminate based on gender identity. So that would give them the ability to decide which team they choose on. And the VPA has put out a bunch of guidance already on that in terms of supporting schools as they work through these issues.
Have you heard questions from school administrators or parents or anyone else since the Trump administration put out this reversal of the Obama executive order?
We did. We had a number of people who reached out to us in part because they were concerned that that some of their children would lose protection. We have parents who are worried about the safety of their children and were concerned about whether this would continue. And, you know, part of the reason we resent the guidance was to reassure people that we actually have policy stability in this space, that because we rooted our best practices in state law, not in federal decisions, that federal action at that level really doesn't have any bearing. It really is a state responsibility at this point. So what the purpose in resending the best practices was to remind people that this really is just a continuation of current Vermont policy.
And so you haven't heard from many school administrators who were concerned, mostly just parents?
When we sent them out again, we did have administrators who thanked us for confirming, so I'm sure it was on some of their minds. But mostly we've heard appreciation for sending out the guidance and a fair amount of appreciation for continuing with this current policy.
Rebecca Holcomb is Vermont's Secretary of Education. Secretary, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
President Trump speaks to a joint session of Congress tonight, and tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll get your reaction. Democratic Congressman Peter Welch will give us his perspective, and we'll hear from the president's supporters in Vermont. You can weigh in, too. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Elder Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.